The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
A military coup has Sudan on edge. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan threatens to kick Western ambassadors out of his country. And Afghanistan tries to stamp out polio. Health experts there are encouraged that the Taliban is putting female workers on the front lines.
Because frankly, you cannot do house-to-house vaccination campaigns without our female colleagues and our female staff being part of these campaigns.
Also ahead, Andy Warhol in Iran, an art exhibit that's sparking conversation.
You've got officials in their lunch breaks going off and having a look at the exhibition, and some are wondering if it's acceptable to paint Chairman Mao and others in this rather subversive fashion. How might Warhol have handled the Ayatollahs who are ruling Iran today?
And speed, power, and athleticism, we're talking Chinese jump rope. I'm Carol Hills. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We begin our coverage for the week in Africa, in Sudan. For the past 2 years, military and civilian leaders were part of a power-sharing government. The goal was to move beyond the 30-year rule of dictator Omar al-Bashir that ended in 2019. But today, Sudan's armed forces seized control. The U.S. State Department is calling for the civilian-led government to be restored. It's also pausing $700 million in aid for Sudan. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports.
The relationship between Sudan's civilian and military side has been tense from the start over the future direction of the country and the country's resources. Today, those tensions reached a turning point when the military arrested top civilian leaders, including Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok and Khalid Omar Youssef, the cabinet affairs minister. I spoke with Youssef's advisor, Abdelmonim Al-Jaq, today.
We still don't know any news about the whereabouts of the prime minister, his wife, five of the ministers, and a number of political leaders who were arrested in the early hours of this morning.
Al-Jaq tells me he's currently in hiding in Khartoum. He says the military is undermining Sudan's democratic transition. General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan had been part of the power-sharing government. In an address on national television today, General Burhan said he was dissolving this government completely for the benefit of Sudan. Jihad Mashamoon is a Sudanese political analyst based in the UK. He says those are the familiar words of a coup leader.
Usually when a coup happens in Sudanese history, they always come like this. They say, given the economic situation, the political and insecurity that's happening, we decided as the military to take over the reins of power.
Sudan's civilian-led government has been struggling to address widespread economic problems and ongoing political instability. Mashamoon says the military seemed to be trying to take advantage of that, but he says today they've made a big miscalculation.
They did not anticipate that people would go out and protest. I believe they anticipated that the people will just be calm because they got tired of the economic crisis.
Videos shared online today show thousands of people in Sudan taking to the streets across the country. There have been reports of soldiers firing on crowds of demonstrators. I spoke with Ayman Saeed, who lives in the capital, Khartoum. He's been joining the protests, which he said began as soon as people heard about the coup.
All the streets were blocked by stones and people refusing this thing from the military and refusing to be governed by the military people.
We lost phone connection shortly after that. The internet and the phone networks across Sudan have been down for most of the day, but Saeed was able to follow up with a text. He told me that it's not the army's job to head the government of Sudan. Give the power back to the people, he wrote. Abdelmonim Al-Jaq, the government advisor, says the international community must act against the leaders of the military coup.
There is a need for a whole isolation from the international and regional community against General Burhan, General Hemeti, and all those who are involved in this coup.
El-Jaq says the United Nations needs to impose sanctions on Sudanese generals, and the country should be removed from the African Union. The United States, which has supported Sudan's civilian-led government financially, says it's deeply alarmed about the situation and calling for the release of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had this message for Western ambassadors over the weekend: get out. Erdogan called for 10 ambassadors, including the American one, to be expelled for statements calling for the release of a Turkish philanthropist. Several of these embassies have now issued statements saying they will not interfere in a host country's internal affairs, and the diplomatic crisis appears to be averted. With us to discuss these events is Soner Çaptay. He's a senior fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Soner, let's start with what caused this diplomatic spat. Who is the jailed philanthropist Osman Kavala, and why has he been imprisoned without trial since 2017?
Mr. Kavala is a philanthropist, a businessman, and someone who is known to support the broadening of liberal democratic civil society in Turkey. And he is at the target of Turkish President Erdogan's venom and anger in recent years. Erdogan sees him as the linchpin of democratic opposition. That's, I think, of course, exaggerated. So he's afraid that his democratic opposition is going to surge and float him out in a tsunami. And I think he's using Mr. Kavala and others as symbols of oppression, letting the opposition and its organizers and civil society leaders know that if they stick their neck out, they too will be arrested.
But I want to stay on Osman Kavala for a second. He's been in prison without trial since 2017. What was he charged with, or why was he detained? What are the specifics against them by Erdogan?
There were large rallies against President Erdogan in 2013, known as Gezi Park rallies. This was the biggest protest movement to date in Turkey's history. The allegations are that Mr. Kavala organized these rallies, and he's the linchpin in this effort to vote Erdogan out.
Now, it's interesting, since these embassies put out statements saying they won't be interfering in Turkey's internal affairs, does it appear that they were pressured into backing down over this case?
No, I would actually say the opposite. I think this is a step back for President Erdogan. It's the first time he's stepping down away from confrontation, because he actually threatened to expel these ambassadors. He said it was a done deal over the weekend. And of course, now I think that his administration has walked back his stated policy. These ambassadors look like they won't be expelled. So this is one of the first instances we see Erdogan is stepping down in the face of a united front of Western countries, U.S. and European countries acting together. It's quite significant. Erdogan, I think, in recent years has benefited from his strongman image domestically. And this step back, of course, will be a big dent in his strongman image.
Turkey's relationship with the U.S. and other Western nations has been strained for some time over a variety of issues. Is this kind of back and forth the new normal between Turkey and the West?
Yes and no. So the assumption was that in recent months, Erdogan had launched the charm offensive. And as a resource-poor country, Turkey needs international investment to return growth. So Erdogan has been for about a year now on his best behavior towards Europe because of deep economic ties with it, and also towards the United States, towards President Biden. He wants to create a narrative of good ties with Biden in order for markets to have confidence to invest in Turkey again.
Turkey's currency is also weathering a crisis as it continues to depreciate. What's behind the falling Turkish lira, and what's the government's role in this?
Largely economic mismanagement, erratic policies. Erdogan detests interest rates or high interest rates, and Turkey has quite high inflation, so that has to be matched with high interest rates. But obviously, he's voting against those policies, and there has been a lot of change at the helm of economic policies.
Is the depreciating Turkish lira going to affect Erdogan's position at home?
Big time. And I think the reason why Erdogan did not follow up with his threat to expel 10 Western ambassadors is because he was told by his advisors that if Turkey had a rupture in its ties with its most important economic partners, that is European countries, it would not only destroy the country's economy, but it would destroy what remains of Erdogan's base.
Soner Çaptay is a senior fellow with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thank you so much.
It's always a great pleasure. Thank you for hosting me.
The guidance in the United States for who needs a COVID-19 booster shot varies. If you got a Moderna or Pfizer vaccine, only certain populations need a booster. But if you got the single-shot Johnson & Johnson, the CDC and FDA are now recommending that everyone 18 and over get a booster. But around the world, the J&J vaccine is hugely popular precisely because it's a single-shot vaccine and easier to administer in hard-to-reach places. So if American scientists now say everyone who got the J&J now needs a booster, what exactly does that mean for the rest of the globe? Here to break this down is the world's Alana Gordon, who covers global health for our program. Alana, what does this mean?
Well, Carol, I think it's interesting that some scientists here in the U.S. are starting to call this Johnson & Johnson vaccine a two-dose vaccine versus a booster. But the bottom line is that this single dose protects people against getting sick, going to the hospital, and dying. The thing with this shot is that some people see it as, in general, less effective than Moderna and Pfizer's vaccines. That's because J&J's protection has been at about 72%. And now researchers found that in very small studies, after a second dose, at least 2 months later, they found it raises the protection against getting sick to above 90%. So that's a lot higher. There's also been some concerns about very rare blood clots with this vaccine, but no new safety concerns have come up.
So do those findings have other places around the globe reconsidering relying on J&J?
So, I mean, the short answer is we're not there yet. I asked Saad Omer about this possibility of moving into a two-shot scenario. He's a vaccine researcher, an advisor to the WHO, and directs Yale's Institute for Global Health.
So I think the one-and-done appeal has become more nuanced.
And what he means is, like, the J&J might soon look like a situation that we have had with the Oxford-AstraZeneca shot. You might remember a lot of places prioritized giving people that first dose because it was effective, but there were still supply shortages. And then as the second dose became available, they followed up. And what Saad Omer says is it was a bigger gap, but it did provide robust protection.
So I could see a scenario where there are countries that start with either two-dose schedule to start with or start with a one-dose prioritization for as many people as possible. But as vaccines become available, they start giving second doses as well.
Again, scientists are still learning about this. The booster situation in the U.S. has been moving ahead super fast. WHO scientists are meeting about boosters next month. But Carol, this is why I also really wanted to know about how this Johnson & Johnson decision is playing out in South Africa.
Why South Africa?
So South Africa has run really big studies with the J&J vaccine. They even vaccinated 500,000 health workers last winter and spring. I spoke with Dr. Glenda Gray about this. She's head of the South African Medical Research Council. It's like the National Institutes of Health there. And she says researchers in South Africa have found that J&J's single shot is durable, meaning it's lasting. And that's based on their assessments through this summer.
And there's definitely value for a single dose vaccine, you know, in your first wave of vaccination. So it provides a critical component of your response.
And so here's where South Africa becomes a really critical part of the global science. The U.S. recommends a second dose at least 2 months out. So we're doing a little bit of math here. But that's based on some very small studies. Gray and others are now trying to find out whether delaying that space between the first and second dose might give better and longer protection. South Africa now is about to give all those health workers a second J&J shot. And that way you can figure out,
if you are a poor country and, you know, you can only get back to the sites in 9 months, then you know that at least that one dose is going to buy you time to come back.
And then provide even more powerful protection.
That's pretty interesting. Alana, we've been talking about the science of these vaccines, but what about the actual supply?
So it's still a major challenge globally. The supply of the J&J vaccine has been really delayed even in South Africa. And that's even where a company is manufacturing the doses. The contract agreements just haven't been filled. Global health leaders continue to be completely outraged about these inequities, especially as wealthier countries move forward with boosters. Saad Omer at Yale, he calls these pledges by wealthier countries to donate vaccines. He gave it this name I hadn't really heard before. He calls it concerned theater.
Ah, so sort of going through the motions of something, but not really delivering.
Yeah, or like looking like you're doing something that might help, but it doesn't actually. And in this case, what he means is there's a lot of talk, but not enough action. That's also why in South Africa, there's been efforts to establish an mRNA hub and figure out the technology behind vaccines like Moderna's to crack that vaccine recipe and make it off patent to make it more accessible.
The World's Alana Gordon. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Israel's defense minister has designated six Palestinian rights groups as terrorist organizations. Israel says the groups are connected to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which has been behind terrorist attacks in the past. The announcement brought swift condemnation. The U.S. State Department said it was never notified of the decision. And human rights campaigners say the terror designations are baseless. Noor Odeh is a media consultant based in Ramallah who was a former spokesperson for the Palestinian Prime Minister's office. I asked her what these six groups do.
These six are basically the creme de la creme of the human rights community in Palestine.
How is Israel linking these groups to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which has been behind terrorist attacks in the past? How are they drawing a line?
Well, I mean, the last reports I've seen is that Israel claims that that evidence is classified. So, so I'm not sure what it has. Basically, Israel used the terror trump card, thinking that it can obscure the fact that these are prominent world-class human rights defenders. They also work internationally. But we have to remember the context. Israel just 2 years ago kicked out Human Rights Watch and it banned its director from operating in the West Bank or Gaza or inside Israel proper. It failed to convince members of Congress who are working with DCI Palestine, Defense for Children International, the Palestine chapter. They're working with them on U.S. legislation about the rights of Palestinian children. Israel tried to lobby European governments that assist and fund these groups to defund them, to basically choke them financially into non-existence, and it failed.
Israel has signaled that they want to allow civil society to do its work in the Palestinian territories. Do these sorts of labels prevent that work from happening?
It doesn't just prevent it, it criminalizes it. So we might see their bank accounts being shut down. Another possible outcome is that we may see these prominent human rights defenders detained and imprisoned, including a much-used Israeli tactic of so-called administrative detention, which is basically using secret evidence to detain someone for an indefinite amount of time of renewable 6 months period. We could see a raid of the Israeli military into the heart of Ramallah to shut down these organizations. We worry that they would happen because they've happened in the past against other organizations.
Israel has offered no evidence for these designations. But if it turned out Israel actually is right about these groups, that there's some kind of connection to the PFLP, what would that mean?
Well, it depends. First of all, Palestinians have a right to political association. The PFLP is not an outlawed political faction in Palestine. I know for a fact that these organizations are run by professionals.
You were a former spokesperson for the Palestinian government. Does this remind you of past disagreements with Israel that you were involved in personally?
When I was spokesperson, it was a different political time, if you will. And these tactics were used, but in a far more limited scope. So we've seen this campaign escalate year by year against all those exposing Israeli violations of human rights or calling for accountability.
Is this kind of accountability a part of this story?
Most definitely. This is the story. The more these organizations have become effective in seeking accountability, the more Israel pushed to shut them down.
Noor Odeh is a former spokeswoman for the Palestinian Authority. She currently works on Palestinian human rights in Ramallah. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
In many places, the turning of the seasons means birds flying south for the winter or heading north once the temperature rises. Here in New England, we're now saying so long to our Canada geese for a few months. But over the decades, bird calendars have been changing. A new study from the UK looked at migratory birds that live between Europe and Africa and found that birds are staying longer in their northern homes. I'm joined by Kieran Lawrence, who's a researcher at Durham University in England. Kieran, which birds did you look at and how much longer are they staying in Europe on average?
We actually looked at some passerine species, so your typical songbird species like pied flycatchers and common redstarts. And what we found was that these species are actually spending about 2 months longer in Europe now than they were about 50 years ago.
Why is that?
We believe it's due to the fact that because of rising temperatures around the globe, we find that springs are occurring earlier and our autumns are more productive. And what this means is that species are required to breed earlier in the year in order to time their breeding and the time that their chicks are around is when they're most their food supply is most plentiful. And that means that they have to depart from Africa earlier each year. And similarly, in autumn, because we're seeing more productive environments towards later autumn, they're able to linger in Europe in the north longer and don't have to go down to their African wintering grounds quite so quickly. For the most part, it appears to be driven by the warming of the globe.
Gee, that's incredible. What could be the ecological impact of this change?
So they might not be all as bad as we might expect, the impact of global warming. We know that migration is a period of very high mortality. And therefore, if they decrease their migration distance, we might actually see positive impacts on the population trends of these species. What there is potential for, however, though, is that if these species continue to linger in Europe over the winter, there might be increased competition with species that already do that. And also in the areas that they used to go to in sub-Saharan Africa, and they play an important role in things like pollination and seed dispersal and maybe control of some insect populations. So if these species are no longer visiting these non-breeding areas, we're unsure what knock-on effects this could have on ecosystems.
Is it possible that some birds will simply stop migrating altogether?
Yes, it's very possible. For example, here in Europe, we have species, the common chiffchaff and the Eurasian blackcap. And these were birds that typically would migrate from Western Europe down to Northern Africa and even Sub-Saharan Africa. However, populations of these species have now developed novel migratory strategies in which they no longer do this. And actually, they come and spend their winters on British shores purely because our winters are now so mild that they're able to eke out an existence over winter here.
My own personal observation has been that there's some birds, some Canada geese, in fact, who simply hang out all winter in New England, whereas many more migrate. What's going on with the ones who stay here year-round?
It might simply be that a subset of these populations has developed an adaptation to stay in maybe a place that isn't necessarily completely beneficial for them to spend the winter. But if there's enough food available and they don't have to take on these long distance migrations, that if it's even remotely possible for them to stay over and not have to complete these migrations, that it's probably beneficial for them to do so.
You looked at a handful of birds in your study, but other studies have also found changing migration in fish, whales, and many different Arctic species. How does your study fit into a larger picture of how climate change is affecting the movement of the world's animals?
Yeah, so this slots in very nicely with a whole wealth of studies that are out there. The warming of the climate that has gone on since the Industrial Revolution in the 1950s, it's causing the distribution of species to move towards the poles. We know that no matter what we do, there's going to be another degree of warming by the end of the century. So there's going to be further change, and we really need to explore how this is going to impact such migratory species.
Kieran Lawrence is a researcher at Durham University in the UK. Thanks a lot, Kieran.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The World. The hot new trend in China these days, jumping rope.
Jumpers ready, set.
Why it's hot and why it's stressing out Chinese parents. Also ahead, Scottish schools become the first to implement a required LGBTQ curriculum. It's on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. Some hopeful news out of Afghanistan. The Taliban have agreed to resume polio vaccinations in the country. That's a big shift. Public health workers have had difficulties trying to get vaccines to people in Taliban-controlled areas. Now, as The World's Shirin Jafari reports, health experts see this opening as a chance to eradicate the disease altogether.
Health workers carrying coolers with polio vaccines knock on the door of a house in a remote area in Afghanistan. They exchange a few words with one mother, and then they squeeze a couple of drops of vaccine into the mouth of a baby. This is from a promotional video put out by Polio Free Afghanistan, an initiative with the goal of eradicating the disease in the country. A couple of drops of vaccine in an infant's mouth is all it takes to help prevent the spread of polio. But in Afghanistan and neighboring Pakistan, vaccine drives have been severely disrupted. Conflict and mistrust among the public have hampered past efforts. Now there seems to be an opening. Last week, the United Nations and the World Health Organization announced that the Taliban have agreed to let vaccination drives continue.
This is the really good opportunity to finally eradicate polio from Afghanistan and Pakistan, and as such, from the world.
Dr. Hamid Jafri is the WHO's director of polio eradication in the region.
Vaccination efforts have missed a lot of children in both Afghanistan and Pakistan. In Afghanistan, you know, we were not able to consistently vaccinate in 3.3 million children for 3.5 years. And in Pakistan also, there are areas where still many children are being missed.
In the past, health workers faced serious security threats when they went door to door to administer vaccines. Extremist groups in Afghanistan and Pakistan labeled them as dangerous foreign agents.
Unknown gunmen killed three female polio vaccination health workers in the Afghan city of Jalalabad on Tuesday.
That was in March of this year. And just 3 months later, another four polio vaccine workers were killed and three injured in separate attacks. The wave of violence in Afghanistan led officials there to suspend the polio eradication drive, leaving millions of children at risk of contracting a preventable disease. Salam al-Janabi, UNICEF's representative in Afghanistan, says the recent agreement with the Taliban is significant because they have now agreed to allow female vaccine workers to take part too.
You cannot do house-to-house vaccination campaigns without our female colleagues and our female staff being part of these campaigns.
It's crucial to have women participate because they often can get better access to mothers and their babies, especially in the more conservative parts of the country. But as hopeful as the news about the polio drive is, Afghanistan is facing a larger humanitarian challenge ahead. When the Taliban took over in August, the U.S. froze roughly $9.5 billion of the country's assets. That's because some members of the Taliban leadership are on U.S. and European sanctions lists. As a result, Afghanistan's health sector is struggling now, says Salam al-Janabi of UNICEF.
Primary and secondary health facilities have collapsed. I mean, we are seeing children who are really in desperate need of treatment for severe acute malnutrition, and health facilities are not able to provide it.
Today, the UN described the overall humanitarian situation in Afghanistan as a countdown to catastrophe. More than half of Afghanistan's population is facing acute hunger with harsh winter months ahead. Taliban officials are urging the international community to give them access to the frozen funds. But the U.S. and others want commitments from the Taliban in return, for example, that they allow high school girls to go back to school. In the meantime, Salam al-Janabi of UNICEF says aid organizations are doing what they can.
As long as we are able to continue these conversations at all levels, we will try and find ways to deliver the necessary and life-saving aid for children, for girls, as we can, while the bigger politics gets sorted out.
In the short term, this winter could turn out to be very difficult for many people in Afghanistan. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafori.
Advocates for human rights are in retreat in Hong Kong. Today, Amnesty International announced it would close its offices there. Amnesty officials say the decision was driven by Hong Kong's national security law, saying it makes it impossible for human rights organizations to work freely and without fear of serious reprisals from the government. The announcement has sent a chill through the shrinking community of political activists on the island. Sia Fun is an independent labor activist in Hong Kong. What does Amnesty International's decision mean for people like you?
The whole attack of the government against civil society has done a huge blow to the morale of Hong Kong people. Every time I meet my friends, even if the topic is not about politics, every time we meet, we already ask each other whether we have renewed our passports and whether we have plans to move elsewhere. And wow. I think the city has arrived at a serious situation that we should think a lot about our strategies to survive here.
Have you been affected yourself by the crackdown?
Government officials have named our organizations, stalked our offices, and hinted at some kind of office raids. We can never feel safe. Even if we are at home or in the office, then we always have to keep alert, nervous, and sometimes very anxious. I'll call this a psychological war against us, quite indirect, but they, at the end, somehow managed to get rid of us. And I don't know if the other colleagues in our labor movement will come back and come together in another way. But I would say the ways that the regime used against the trade unions were quite nasty and tricky. I know that the regime is keeping an eye on all of us.
It sounds as though you're feeling rightfully anxious. What sort of precautions are you taking?
Of course, at one hand, I would consider my words as to whether they would become some evidence for the regime to charge me or to accuse me of triggering hatred to the government. And on the other hand, I'm also anxious about the future of Hong Kong, as with everybody else here. We don't know the risk. And yet, the most struggling part is that we know it's not the time for us to give up. To give up the path fighting for democracy and freedom.
A Hong Kong court today convicted activist Ma Chun Man of inciting secession. What's the importance of that ruling?
He is the second defendant being sentenced officially under the national security law. That's the point for us to get anxious and worried.
In the meantime, are you determined to stay put in Hong Kong?
I say so. At least I always remind myself to not renew the passports. Otherwise, it would just become a very big encouragement for me to apply for another visa or to formulate a plan. But as I'm staying, I will still get stuck in Hong Kong. Should I pursue an ordinary job or should I seek another opportunity to build civil society, and at the same time bearing the same level of risk as I was somehow quite burnt out or overwhelmed? That's a quite personal problem to me. I have to face myself and treat it quite serious, but it's really a bad impact if I just give up and then move elsewhere. Because even if I pursue my beliefs and campaign outside Hong Kong, I will just be someone on exile and not someone really creating an impact within the city. And that's the big difference to me. We still have to educate the next generation and to wait for the time for us to come back. The problem is when and how, and that's where it is.
C.F. Fan is an independent labor activist in Hong Kong. I really appreciate you speaking to us.
Yeah, my pleasure too. Thank you so much for inviting us.
Scotland is making some big strides toward inclusion in classrooms. The country has become the first in the world to require an LGBTQ curriculum in schools. The World's Bianca Hillier has the story.
Jordan Daly remembers being a queer kid in Scotland.
At my school, LGBT people were the butt of jokes. It was something to be embarrassed about. It was something that you should be ashamed of. And that was certainly the messages that I got. You know, the experiences that I had pretty much destroyed my self-confidence.
Daly is not alone. LGBTQ students experience higher rates of bullying than their straight and cisgender peers in the U.S., according to the CDC. Daly, who is 26, is trying to change that in Scotland with an educational approach. He's the director and co-founder of Time for Inclusive Education, the charity that has worked with the government to get LGBTQ curriculum into every school across the country.
It took us 3 years overall from being set up to getting the Scottish government to agree to take this work forward.
The work will take a few years to fully roll out, but teachers in Scotland can get started right away. They now have access to a wide range of inclusive lesson plans and resources, plus free training for how to teach these courses to their students. Many of the lessons cover global LGBTQ icons, including Lady Gaga. The course includes the pop star's LGBTQ anthem, Born This Way, and looks at how Gaga pushed for legal protections when one of her young fans died by suicide after being bullied online. Daly says this lesson is meant to teach about the impact of bullying and show queer youth they're not alone.
If I had sat through that lesson at school, I would have immediately understood there are other people who have experienced this. There are other people like me out there, and I have got so much to be proud of, and I think that would have completely changed my life.
Other lessons include how to respond to someone saying, "That's so gay," and how to start a gay-straight alliance at school. Teachers are also encouraged to fold queer people into everyday learning, like a math problem about a girl needing to buy her two dads a Father's Day card. Daly and his team developed this curriculum alongside LGBTQ students, teachers, and researchers like Ashley Douglas. She helped create a lesson plan around Poem 49 from 16th century Scotland.
It's one woman writing to another woman about how much she adores her and loves her and how she wishes she could marry her. Like, there's no way to not read it as a lesbian poem.
The poem is unsurprisingly anonymous, and it's one of the earliest known lesbian poems in Europe. Douglas says it's important to include works from long ago in today's curriculum.
I think it's really powerful to have examples of historical gay figures in literature just to make that point that gay people have always been around and always will be.
The lessons are tailored for kids of all ages, but Scott Mowat, a head teacher in Glasgow, says having an LGBTQ inclusive curriculum won't just benefit students. It'll also help queer teachers like him, who were long told not to talk about their personal lives in school.
We can't truly make our schools LGBT inclusive environments if our staff and families can't be themselves. Everyone's got to feel comfortable being themselves. And that's okay if people don't want to share as well, but people shouldn't feel the need to hide it in school.
Scotland's initiative is in stark contrast to many efforts to exclude LGBTQ education around the world. In the U.S., at least 5 school districts have banned pride flags from classrooms, calling them a political symbol. And last week in London, parents of a primary school protested sex education and LGBTQ-inclusive lessons. But in Scotland, organizer Jordan Daly says his team has not received substantial pushback on the initiative. Other countries from across the globe have even reached out, he says, to see if the Scottish model could work for them. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
When you think of Andy Warhol and his art, images of Campbell's soup cans or colorful silk screens of Marilyn Monroe may come to mind. Warhol was a purveyor of pop culture and some of the most iconic images in modern art. You might find it surprising, then, to learn that some of Warhol's work has been on display in Iran. It's an exhibition that dovetailed with the election of Ebrahim Raisi, a hardline cleric who won Iran's presidential election in June. Nicholas Pelham, Middle East correspondent for The Economist, reported on the Warhol exhibit.
Warhol is a quintessentially American pop artist. His paintings overall are subversive and sexualized and mocking of authority, not what you'd have thought would really be the taste of Iran's mullahs.
But Pelham says there was a time not so long ago when Warhol was embraced by the rulers of Iran.
Warhol ought to have been a particular bugbear of theirs because he was a favourite at the Shah's pre-revolutionary court. When other artists distanced themselves from the Shah and his entourage, he was feasting on their bowls of caviar and flattering the Shah and his empress with portraits. And in fact, this Museum of Contemporary Art, which was built in the last years of the Shah, was built in part to house his and other Western works, as well as Iranian works. So it's surprising you're seeing this resurrection of Warhol once again.
After the Iranian Revolution of 1979, Islamic law was instituted, and secular and Western items like Warhol's art were banned and then sat in the vault at the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art. So this begs a question, why now? Why is Iran's government allowing a major retrospective of Warhol's work to be displayed once again? Here's Nicholas Pelham again.
Morale is really low in Iran at the moment. It's been battered by sanctions. The local currency has all but collapsed. And if the authorities can do something to revive morale, allowing a retrospective of Warhol might be kind of one way in which they could do that. Iran is a proud nation. It doesn't like to be left behind in the region. It can look at what's happening elsewhere on the Arab side of the Gulf and see the state-of-the-art museums that are opening there, and just wants to kind of perhaps send a message to its own population that Iran is up to an exhibition of global standards as well.
And the Warhol exhibition has been a success, even with the current hardline conservative government.
Pro-government newspapers have run positive reviews. It was a particular surprise that you should have had this retrospective because on his first day in office, Iran's new culture minister, Mohammad Ismaili, vowed to purge Iran of output which he deemed deviation and secularism, of anything really smacking of Americana. And yet he's not batted an eyelid. You've got officials in their lunch breaks going off and having a look at the exhibition, and some are wondering if it's acceptable to paint Chairman Mao and others in this rather subversive fashion. How might Warhol have handled the Ayatollahs who are ruling Iran today? Might he have painted their turbans and their lips as well?
The Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art reopened back in June after almost 3 years of renovations. It first opened in 1977 and today houses more than 3,000 pieces of modern art from Europe, the United States, and Iran itself. Nicholas Pelham says for many, the museum's decision to reopen with a Warhol exhibition is bittersweet.
The museum is a reminder of where Tehran was 44 years ago when it opened before the revolution. At that time, it was probably the most progressive country in Asia. So this kind of Warhol retrospective is as much a reminder of where Iranians were rather than a glimmer of hope for the future.
Nicholas Pelham of The Economist talking about an Andy Warhol exhibit at the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art. And thanks to our partners at the Intelligence Podcast from The Economist for sharing that with us. I can't sugarcoat this one. We've got more bad news for the planet. Concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere just keep going up. 2020 saw the highest levels ever, according to an annual report released today by the World Meteorological Organization, the UN's weather and climate science arm.
This is a reality check.
Oksana Tarasova is the head of atmospheric environment research at the World Meteorological Organization.
Our concentrations increased again, and they are growing with increasing rate. So we are not doing what we are supposed to do.
We're supposed to be cutting back our carbon emissions now, dramatically. Humanity has gotten away with burning fossil fuels for as long as we have because more than half of the carbon dioxide we emit gets sucked up by the land or oceans. They're effectively cleaning much of our pollution. But that may change if we keep pumping warming gases into the atmosphere, says Tarasova.
Both our ocean and the biosphere, they have their limits. In some parts of the world, the conditions, like the climate change itself, lead to increased mortality of the trees. So they are not taking up as much CO2 as they were doing before.
In recent years, parts of the Amazon rainforest have flipped from capturing carbon to emitting it. Both deforestation and a changing climate are killing trees there, and some forests can't remove as much carbon dioxide anymore. Something similar could one day happen in the world's oceans. As water warms, Tarasova says, it's less able to absorb CO2 from the atmosphere.
It's like when you take your Coca-Cola and there's a lot of gas, and if you start warming your Coca-Cola, all the gas goes out. You cannot pump the gas in if the water is warm. This is what is happening with the ocean.
Today's report was issued ahead of the major UN climate summit that starts in Glasgow next week. Politicians had hoped the summit would end with a clear pathway to limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Now scientists and politicians are warning that might not happen. Here's British Prime Minister Boris Johnson today.
It's going to be very, very tough, this summit.
And I'm very worried because it might go wrong and we might not get the agreements that we need. And it's touch and go. It's very, very difficult, but I think it can be done.
If the world acts quickly, which so far it hasn't. Today, the UN warned that the carbon-cutting pledges countries have already made continue to fall short. And even if nations did meet their goals, pledged under the groundbreaking Paris Climate Agreement, greenhouse gas emissions would keep rising throughout the decade. Flip through the TV channels in China these days, and there's a good chance you'll find this.
Judges ready. Jumpers ready. Set.
TV shows featuring jump rope competitions. We're not just talking the double dutch here. These jump ropers are amazing, bouncing with speeds you can't imagine. But Chinese viewers aren't only watching to be entertained. The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai tells us why skipping rope has become so competitive for young Chinese students.
This past summer, before Yolanda Cheng's daughter started first grade, her new school sent out a notice. Students must be able to jump rope more than 100 times in a minute.
So at the beginning, I feel it's just you force me to jump. I don't like it. If you don't do it, your score in the primary school will be like no pass. She has to do that.
Her daughter is athletic. Cheng has signed her up for ballet, swimming, traditional Chinese dance, tennis and soccer. But she could only jump rope 10 times in a row.
My daughter at that time was very poor at rope jumping, so I pay attention to that.
So they got to work. Cheng had her daughter jump rope for a minute every morning before breakfast.
Jump up.
Like many other parents around China, she took a video and uploaded it to an app called Jump Rope Every Day. The app counts the number of jumps, and like in an arcade game, kids vie to be the top scorer. A little girl in central Henan province currently holds the records for most skips per minute, 278. In her video, she wears a determined look on her face as she jump ropes on a yoga mat in her family's living room. You can barely see the rope as it flies through the air. Most kids aren't that fast. After school and on the weekends in parks around China, you'll see kids jumping rope under the watchful eye of parents or grandparents. In China, where classrooms can have upwards of 40 students, jump rope is a relatively inexpensive sport, and it doesn't take up much space either, so it's become a popular measure of students' fitness. And it's not just a requirement, it impacts your final grade. But not everyone is a natural. So some parents sign their kids up for jump rope cram classes. At this after-school jump rope center, teachers take students through stretches and exercises and then coach them on the finer points of skipping rope. The kids master all sorts of moves, even double dutch. My neighbor, Lillian Zhang, sent her son. We didn't pay attention to jump rope before, so he could only jump 3 or 4 times, she says. His coordination isn't so good, but I didn't want it to affect his confidence level. Huang Haimin works at the jump rope center. Parents bring their kids to the center because they want them to have an edge, she says. The jump roping requirement might sound silly, but Lenora Chu says it highlights how China's education system sorts people into categories. She's an education expert and author of a book on China's education system.
It's basically like climbing a ladder with a test at every rung of the ladder. So they will prioritize what is on those tests. Now, if the Beijing government comes down to say, we now think that physical education and health is important, and here's how we're going to measure it, then parents in turn will then value what they're told to prioritize.
Recent education reforms in China have shut down after-school and weekend tutoring centers. But Chu says families are still looking for any way for their kids to get ahead.
And as long as those testing mechanisms are there, and they're so critical and important, then anything that they do is not going to take away that pressure.
But parent Yolanda Cheng is encouraged by the stronger emphasis on physical education.
And I always think in the future, the competition is not just like your IQ, your academic performance. It's really on how energetic you will be, you know.
She says for all her annoyance at being forced to send videos of her kids skipping rope every day, it worked. After spending the summer cramming jump rope with her daughter, she saw an improvement.
You know, she can jump 120, even higher. for only 1 minute, and then she can jump only with one foot. And she was very happy at that.
And Cheng says recently she actually went out and bought a jump rope for herself. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow.